Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. This may or may not be the last show broadcast out of the Tribune Tower. The paper, including me, left the tower on Friday, and I saw our new digs in the Prudential Building, and they're very nice. But part of this whole life changes, and the city's an organic place, and my guest, Lisa Haynes, and I grew up together in Old Town in the 60s, and Old Town, in some ways, Lisa, it hasn't changed at all. I mean, except for the hipper look of the people and the better jobs they have.
It's a time capsule, isn't it?
It is.
And down here, there's just building after building after building.
So this is a big deal, I think, for you to be in the last, what may or may not be the last broadcast out of here. When we grew up, we grew up in, I think, what is a kind of relatively bohemian area with bohemian folks who prided themselves on loving words and loving music and loving certain kinds of freedom, some of them a bit out there, but most of them really good ways to live. That had to inform you as a writer, give you a certain foundation. It did me, though I certainly didn't think about it at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, just the idea that to be a journalist was to explore very deeply, and you wouldn't allow anyone to limit you. And my mother, in particular, was very confrontational with people like Mayor Daley, the first.
Tell people what your mother did, Virginia.
So she had a column in the Chicago Daily News for a few years in the 60s. And before that, she was with Chicago's American. And that's where my stepfather, Norton Kay, he started out. He actually started out on the City Bureau, I believe.
City News Bureau, yeah.
Yeah. And so and then he was the political editor. So I remember walking into the newspaper all the time and going into the city room, hearing the sound of the typewriters, going down and watching the presses roll, sound, that thunder.
It was it's very easy to over-romanticize it, but for two people like us who are newspaper kids, it's not over-romanticizing.
Oh,
the sound of a typewriter, which I sometimes hear in my sleep, is, I literally think, the first sound I ever heard.
And as a little girl, we would be in a big booth in McConnell's, which I don't know if that's around anymore.
Yeah.
And all the reporters smoking and drinking and having burgers and
See,
so on.
See, those were the good old days, the smoking and drinking part of it. I did, in a piece I wrote today in Sunday's Tribune, I literally thought, because now this tower that we're in is going to be filled with people who have much better jobs than a reporter, editor, writer, who can afford million-dollar condos. And I have one of my fantasies is that one of them will wake up in about 4 years out of a deep sleep and go, "Oh, my God, honey, I smell cigarette smoke. I smell cigarette smoke. We got to get out of this building."
They can watch the tea on the Trump Tower drop to the ground.
Well, see, the Trump Tower is built on what was the Sun-Times Daily News building, and this place did house what was the Tribune and Chicago's American, which changed to Chicago Today. When did you first start to write, Lisa?
I don't recall a time when I wasn't making
writing
up poems and songs and little stories. And I think I remember the first time I could tell a three-sentence story.
What was
and
it?
That was just elation. I don't know, something about the spring or something. And I think I was nine when I wrote my first novel. It was about a cat.
Yeah.
And I took the typewriter that my parents worked on and put that green newspaper print.
Sure. When did you then, we never really fell apart emotionally, but we fell apart physically, and you went away to college, and when did you get it in your mind that you wanted to be a writer? This could be my profession.
Well, I began in poetry, really, in college.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I wrote forever, but that was when things really kind of took off. And I was aware that I might never make anything out of that.
Sure.
how many poets can really support themselves at all, right?
There are many poets who can't even buy themselves a drink.
So it was after college and working in my own little garret that I finally said, I definitely want to write a novel. I want to see what I can stir up, and that novel is buried somewhere.
Well, but your first novel is not buried, and your first novel, In My Sister's Country, it was a revelation to me. I have really, not just because we're old and dear friends, I have loved all of your books.
Thank
I even
you.
Left Girl in the Arena. I want to talk about it, even though it's like a young adult book about girls, mostly. You were teaching, too, and you've been teaching for some time.
I have, and I started out teaching in City College Extension and so on. I've taught almost every age, and I've been now at Emerson since 2002, and then I stepped out for a year. I taught at Harvard, and I'm back at Emerson.
What do you get? I taught once. I taught a reviews and criticism course at Columbia, and I thought, first of all, these kids shouldn't be writing, and second of all, I shouldn't be teaching. It was a perfect double combination. What do you get out of writing? I would think there is something that a writer gets, because you're hearing other ideas. You're every day in a nurturing idea factory.
It's such a mix of things. At Emerson, they're very emo, and they're very diverse in many ways, and they're especially with gender, we're known for that. And then they're talented. They're just talented. Now, that doesn't mean everyone is a great talent.
Yeah, sure.
But when you find those talents, you really enjoy nurturing them. But I love the classroom. I'm sort of a sit-down comic in the classroom. I try not to get into too much trouble. And we talk about everything. We talk about movies. We talk about art. We talk about life, what's going on.
See, I think that's a really healthy place for a writer to be. Lisa's going to be here for this entire first hour. The title of her latest book, and I just love this. I'm going to read portions of it for you in the second half hour, is When We Disappear. Just published a really haunting cover. Much of it takes place in the city of Chicago, and a bit of it in a cemetery between Chicago and Evanston. I'm going to read a portion of that. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'm talking to Lisa Haines. We are getting into, she's talked to you about teaching. We've talked about growing up in Old Town. We've talked about being scions of a journalism families. Her first book, how empowering was that, not just to get it published, Lisa, but to finish it? I mean, it is not an easy thing to write a novel. And the first one was In My Sister's Country, which I loved.
Thank you. So I'm so driven. I have to keep going. And in fact, the second novel that was published,
Small Acts of Sex and Electricity, which is a great title. Great title.
Thank you. So that book, I had the entire book written, and then I thought, this isn't really working, and I knocked it down to one chapter and started over. So that gives you a sense of how crazy I am.
Of your driven, nature. This is a very, very, very wicked time in the publishing business.
As
you
know,
anybody in the publishing business knows that the average consumer may not, or the people down it. How was your crowd yesterday? Lisa was a member of the Litfest gang of authors, the Printers Row Litfest. How did you find that? Did you find the whole scene kind of encouraging?
It was wonderful to see so many people out in the streets, and the classroom that the other authors and I were in, it was packed. Except it was about female desire. And I guess there were a couple of guys who wanted us to really talk about sex.
Did they really? I thought Stormy Daniels was going to be there.
And they got up and left.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not.
They thought the topic was female. Not female desire is represented in fine novels, but just female desire.
Right.
So they thought they were really in a classroom. We're going to learn all about it.
Yes.
Oh, that's something. But it is something to see. I mean, it gives one a bit of hope
this
strange business. Now, When We Disappear, from which I'm going to read later in this, it's gotten some amazing jacket quotes, as we say, Robert Olin Butler, who won the Pulitzer Prize for a collection of short stories in, I think, about 1993, wrote this: "When We Disappear is a remarkable novel that does what only great fiction can do. It explores the profound interaction between our individual inner lives and the outer world, particularly that most immediate and influential corner of the world, family. In great fiction, this is. Lisa Haynes has long been one of my favorite writers. When We Disappear reveals her at the peak of her prodigious power." When you send a book to someone like Robert Owen Butler and say, "Hi, would you read my book and possibly give me a jacket quote?" and that comes back, what's your reaction?
Well, you start out and you ask first before you send the book.
Yeah.
And you're in heaven. You really are in heaven, right? And Tom Perata.
Sure. Tom Perata says is a little shorter. "When We Disappear tells the story of a family in a country fallen on hard times and burdened by the weight of the past. Lisa Haynes is a novelist of great empathy and penetrating insight." Yeah, that too works. And then eventually you can put Rick Cogan and say, "This is a great book." Once we get deeper into the book, you can go... Lisa's daughter, Sienna, has created a website for her, and it is Lisa Haynes, LiseHaines.com, where you can buy all of her books. Before we end this half hour, Girl, you told me about Girl in the Arena long before you wrote it, and I was ever curious what drew you to a young adult novel after two very adult novels.
It was written as adult, and the market was really good for young adult, and I had a young protagonist, and that was it. I really didn't change the work to suit the market.
But just how they wanted to market this.
Yes, it was an alternate reality. It's the idea that now we have gladiator sport as big as the NFL, and not the safe gladiator sport with batons and cargo nets, but the real thing. And it's a dark satire. And for some reason, that just hit the market at the right time. Hunger Games, we were writing... She was writing Hunger Games while I was writing my book.
Do you feel like, Lisa, even as accomplished as you are as a writer, as a kind of pawn in this, since you've started, we were talking about this before we went on, in the era that you have been writing, you started writing at an era where the publishing business started to get crazy and crazier and crazier. Simply getting a book published, yours is being published by Unbridled Books, is an incredible accomplishment. Do you feel, in a sense, kind of up against it as a writer?
Oh, sure. I think we all do right now. And you have to believe in yourself so much. And people always ask you, what kind of advice? And that's part of it, is to believe in yourself and to do the work, to show up for the job.
Now, the kids in your writing class, are they all aspiring novelists, or some, never having gone to college or taught college, what do I know? But they can't all be aspiring novelists, short story writers, or poets. They may be taking it for other reasons.
Right. Sometimes I get somebody who's actually in the film program, visual media arts, and somebody from communications and so on. And they just want to brush up their skills about story. Because even though we're shifting more to a visual world at this point, it's still reliant upon story.
Oh, no question. Yeah, no question.
And so you have to hold out the hope that those stories will keep getting transmitted in a variety of ways, including books.
There are, in this book, When We Disappear, a number of, if not a lot of different ghosts, a number of kind of ghosts and people thinking they see ghosts. What's it like when you come back to, you don't come back to Chicago enough for my taste, but when you do come back, there have to be ghosts here for you too, aren't there?
Well, right now for me, probably more than anything, it's my stepfather, Norty, and...
To whom the book is dedicated.
Yes, and I just ache from missing him. He was a real giant in my life. So I see him everywhere. I think about how he would respond to things. How would he respond to the world as it is right now?
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy, and
Well, he was a very smart, as was your mom, a very smart guy. And
your parents, too.
Well, but I mean, and they were all kind of sophisticated in the ways
yes.
that the city works and that politics works and that, in many ways, how life works, I think, also.
I think so,
and that's one of the things that distinguishes your book there. It is a, you know people. I mean, you know certainly these characters in this book, and you're able to bring them to life. And I think that goes a long way to, as we started this half hour, to the way in which we both grew up in a lovely sort of feeling. I don't want to make it too touchy-feely, but it wasn't that way, because they could all be sharp-tongued, all of
sure.
these people, too, and tough about, and no BS about the way life
Absolutely.
Was and the way life treated them. We are going to dip deeply into When We Disappear after some commercials and the news, so please stay tuned. Again, you can go to Lisa's website, LISEHAINES.com, and you can start ordering her three previous books, and then by the time you've done that, we'll be back, and you can learn about this one and then order that at the end of the show. Alan Barkas for musical bumps today, because he's a talented guy. Lisa Haines is here, and we have gone through our childhood together in Old Town, our families in the journalism business, her teaching at Emerson and Harvard, and now we dip into her latest novel, which has just been published. It's called When We Disappear. It is, you have taken a real risk here, I think, but pulled it off, by having two first-person narrators, a, I think, 17-ish
yes.
year old daughter named Mona, and a father named Richard, who is not present in Mona's life. That is a fascinating. Was it fun? Because you create, I know them both, having read the book. I really do know them.
That's great. I began with Mona, and I wrote that whole section out first, and then I just decided that I needed the father. So I was trying to figure out, how am I going to distinguish their voices?
Sure.
Because I understood who they were and their different attitudes, but how was I going to? So every time I would hear Richard's voice, I would imagine he was speaking in an Irish accent to just give it a different rhythm.
I'm going to read, much of the book is, there's a kind of down-and-out nature to some
yes.
of this, especially with Richard's life. Here, just, and it gives you an example of what a stylish writer Lisa Haines is. This is one of the Richard chapters. I didn't have enough to rent another place, but it was a mild winter. I lived out of a backpack I got at a second-hand store. I bought a cheap sleeping bag and pad, and I used the alarm clock on my phone. Most nights I walked until I found a safe spot to shut my eyes. Some nights I spent in laundromats. I thought of Mona sleepwalking at night, wondering what she was trying so hard to find, scared half to death that she'd leave their apartment building in her sleep. Before I left Newark, he's in Newark, New Jersey, I got more of her postcards, terrible images that kept me from getting any rest. That's really awfully good writing. I mean, just from those two paragraphs, you really know Richard. I don't know what you call it. You're a teacher. What do you call it? The book turns on an accident, sort of. A turn is not the right word.
It's that one big event.
Yeah.
Especially in her life. And so there's been a hit and run. If I tell too much about it, I'll
yeah,
give
right,
it away.
Right, yeah.
But you know who came in handy in writing this was, what was his name? Governor Lobovitch?
Lobovitch.
Okay. Because he's the as bad as the guy was, he changed the statute of limitations.
That's right.
And took them off so that anyone could be prosecuted for a hit and run for forever, really.
Forever. And now our great president is about to probably let him out of jail. What, when you say you were writing the Mona, you were creating this character of Mona.
Yeah.
And then how, tell me, Lisa Haynes, how then did the novel start to change? Did you hear a story? Did you remember something?
It's usually for me, it's in bits and pieces. It's, I hear a phrase or I see an image and then I start going from there. And essentially I'm living in a fictional dream. So to me I have very, very vivid dreams. So it is as vivid as my waking life and walking around, and it's as vivid as my dream life.
Mm.
So I feel like I'm inside these characters and with them, in the room with them, breathing with them.
One of the other hallmarks of your writing is you do research, and it shows, because the factual nature of what's going on here is so seamlessly tied into this. Much of when you're researching, like, what can go wrong with a car, like what things happen with a car, that's really this day and age. You don't have to go talk to a mechanic. You can just sit down and Google things that you need to know. But when you were dealing with your own memories, and a lot of this book is set in Chicago, it becomes a real different thing. You almost, and I get a sense, though we done the intimate journey here, that you revisit some places that you may be writing about to get a sense of them. Do you or do you not, or am I just...
No, absolutely. And sometimes that defies your research. So I was... The first place that I ever lived was on Juneway Terrace in Rogers Park. And when my mother was pregnant with me, she looked out at the cemetery.
Yeah.
And that same area is where I had a boyfriend later, and then my stepfather lived in that area. It's just I keep circling around, just like Crilly Court. It's a pivotal place in my life where we lived.
Sure.
And when I realized I was setting the book there, I went back and I drove around and I went, oh my God, they've taken out these old rickety wooden supports for the elevated train. And it's all concrete now.
Yeah, yeah.
But I couldn't give that up. So though I knew it was concrete, I set it in current day with those old wooden supports because I had to hear that clack that it made.
Yeah.
And I had to see that someone could jump off those wooden ties to the ground. And
you had to. I mean, it's sort of, in a way, it's refreshing a memory and also resurrecting a memory, because you may not have, you know, whatever it's become, your mind is taken back to what it was. And you then, as a writer, make the choice of, well, maybe I should just update my memory. Or, and in some cases, memory is such a wonderfully wicked thing that what you trust as your memory winds up not being true.
Well, so many people who write memoirs, they talk about the fact that the people who are in their families that are written about say, oh, that's not the way it was, or that's not me, or
yeah.
How dare you write that? So with fiction, you have ultimate liberty.
Freedom.
You have total freedom.
Yeah, the freedom we were talking about, learning, growing up in Old Town.
And now, by the way, can I just say that I
say
used
anything.
To outrun Jewish. You? I could beat you in a race. Over and over again, I did.
Really?
Yes, I did.
Well, you should have
we
put
were
that,
12.
You should put that in
I
your,
should have put that on the
put
back
your,
cover.
Put it in your author's note.
Yes.
My God. And then again, I used to beat Rick Kogan in a race. I was fast, too.
You were, but not
well,
that
I'm sorry
fast.
You didn't want to be in the Olympics then. Richard, the father, is gone. Mona is at home with her mom, who is Liza, and her little daughter, who is Lola, right?
Right.
Lola's real little.
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is she kind of... The other fascinating thing about Mona, and I think it's true of you, too, she's like a photography nut, right?
Right. I love photography. And so I had a chance to read a lot on photography, look at just unending images. And there is a nod paid to Vivian Meyer in this book.
Sure.
The woman who lives next door that Mona takes a preoccupation about because she sees her going out in this old coat, taking a camera with her. And I used the list of cameras that Vivian Meyer had in the book and gave them to this woman. But I didn't want to say she was Vivian Meyer because a whole responsibility.
Oh, no question. Right. And there are enough books about Vivian Meyer out there to satisfy any fan of Vivian Meyer's. See, it's wonderful, and what you people are listening to is the way an author's mind works. It is this wonderfully wicked combination of memory and stories heard and snatches of conversation. And, you know, I'm not saying Mona is the 17-year-old Lisa Haynes, but there's something about that, too, because I remember the 17-year-old Lisa Haynes. Yeah, there are not enough sprinting contests in the book for my mind. We're trying to tell you about When We Disappear without giving away too much of it. I have told you that it's in the two voices of Richard, the sort of absent father. Can we say why he's absent?
Well, he loses his job, so the idea is that the pretext is that he's gone off to another state. But you can also feel because he gets involved in carnival culture, circus culture through this uncle of his, that he really wants to just escape.
Yeah, that is.
And he doesn't even say goodbye to the family. Yeah. He just takes off early in the morning.
That's how the book begins. He shut off the alarm clocks, loaded his car, used his handbrake out, and backed down the drive without turning the engine over. Richard, my father, was probably in Indiana by now. He had tossed his house keys on the counter as if he wouldn't be back. An envelope was propped on the kitchen table with the letter written to Liz, my mother. That's a very, very good beginning. We're going to talk a little bit more about the book when we come back after a short, short commercial break. And I will read you a little portion of one of Mona's chapters. We'll be right back. It's Alan Barkus, and that's a good philosophy for anybody out there. I have a few more minutes, maybe 10 minutes more, with Lisa Haynes talking about her latest novel, When We Disappear, a great deal of which is set in Chicago. I just read you a portion earlier set in Newark, New Jersey, where the poor dad, Richard, is scrambling. This goes to, Lisa was talking about, you know, being up in Rogers Park, an area of Rogers Park that we used to call the jungle. It could be a tough area. But here, Mona, the 17-year-old in the book, one of the two main voices in the book, has been hitchhiking. And she says, this guy who kept looking over at me like he wasn't sure I was sitting there in the car took me north. Along the way, I felt dizzy and my stomach clenched. I asked him to drop me off at the cemetery. He took me right there without asking for directions. Some people have a way of finding death. The lake was iced over, and the only sound came from the cars fleeing around the curve. Looking across the gravestones and mausoleums, I saw some half-finished repair work. No one in sight, only a slow van on its way out of the main gate. In the warmer seasons, the waves pounded against the limestone break on the other side of Sheridan, and mist comes off the lawn as the morning temperatures shift. There have been reports of seeing an aviator out in the lake. The aviator has a routine where he struggles to stay afloat, but ultimately drowns. Then his ghost hauls itself up out of the water, crosses Sheridan, and enters the cemetery where it disappears. Ghosts are all over this book, Lisa Haynes, aren't they?
And memories are ghosts, right?
Yeah.
And Mona has a really hard time staying within herself.
Yes.
Because she also, like the father, has fled to Newark. She's trying to flee from the things that have happened in her life. And so she does some what we call astral traveling. She gets out of her body at night. She sleepwalks. She feels like she's actually entering somebody else's body. It's not something I'm trying to prove or that she could say this actually happened, But it's that odd feeling you get at times.
Well, you do I'm not giving anything away here by saying that something quite similar to that, which I find maybe a little ambiguous, happens at the very, very, very end of the book. You have not gotten any, the book is just out, you have not gotten any reviews yet, because the book is just out and very few people even review books these days. What are your hopes for this book? I think this would be a remarkable movie, and I guess every author in the world would go, hey, that'd be great. Yeah, send me the check.
I think everybody hopes that they'll get a wide readership, that people will be passionate about the book as much as the author is. But I love the idea of a movie. I'm a movie-holic.
Yeah.
As well as photography, and so I had a deal with HBO for my last book, Girl in the Arena, and they wrote the pilot and so on, but it just,
it's a movie business.
Just happen sometimes.
What did your daughter, Sienna, think of this book?
Oh, she's very connected. She often gives me advice on my work. If I get into a stuck place, I'll say, well, I've got my characters here and there, and what do you think? And she will often come up with an answer. She came up with an answer to the end of Girl in the Arena for me.
Yeah.
Now, I guess I better start putting her on the dole, right?
That's
or
right.
More on the dole,
yeah.
Right?
Is she on the dole now?
Well, you know, when you get through college. But she's through college now. So.
Well, but she has made your website. She has made the website. She created the website.
And she's over at WGBH now doing gaming.
Sounds
in the children's
great.
Division.
She's a nice kid.
She's
LisaHaines.com is the website, and the way to spell it is LisaHaines.com. You can be very proud of this book, and do your students, obviously your students know who you are and what you do. How does that affect the rhythm of the class? Are the best students are the ones who are really, like, you know, struggling for A's, go out and say, oh, Ms. Haines, I loved your novel. I read it in one sitting overnight.
Well, you get a couple of people like that. I try and make it about their work. And if they've read something, and I always like to read the authors that I was working with.
Yeah.
So it's nice when they do that. But it's really about who they are and what their voice is about.
We're trying to round this out perfectly. We talked about where we grew up and some of the influences we had, parental influences.
Yes.
What writers have influenced you most profoundly? I know that can change with every decade or every new book. Or are there some that have just really, really helped you find your foundation as a writer?
Boy, there's so many. I think one of the modern writers that I like is Lily Tuck, the woman who walked on water, the woman who shot a man. Laurie Moore.
Sure.
I'm big on her.
Poets, too, because you were, you know,
sure,
the
except
early...
when I wanted to shift from poetry to fiction, I stopped reading poets.
Wow.
Very intentionally. It was hard because I had worked with a number of poets.
Sure.
But I just said, that's it. If I'm ever going to learn how to write fiction, I have to disconnect from the form.
Yeah. I remember some of your poetry, which
Do
I read, and it was good.
Yeah. Okay.
It was good. Was that a hard thing to give up?
No, because I suddenly thought, novels to me felt like, oh, three-dimensional chess. This is fascinating. It's like, oh, hey, I think I'll go out and be a brain surgeon. So it was too much fun.
Do you like in Emerson? I mean, do you have a community out there of writers with which you hang out? Certainly not the same here as it was years and years ago. And, you know, people, I don't know what they do. They sit at home and watch TV.
Yeah, we have Penn New England, which is a wonderful organization. You can go to a reading any night of the week, and you'll probably see someone you know.
Wow.
We all try and support each other as much as we can. So.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you spent some time, just to finish this whole thing off, at Ragdale, which is
this
extraordinary kind of writer's colony in Lake Forest.
And there was a ghost in my room.
What was the name?
I can't remember her name, but I saw her in the
window.
Do
women always think of dream of men ghosts and vice versa?
Oh, now that I don't know.
But that's what those guys, Josh Knoll, who's my next guest and a colleague of mine, will find it. I don't know if you did anything at Printer's Row, but Lisa was two other authors. Tell that story again. There, two other authors, and the topic was...
Right, Rana Reiko Rizzuto and Julia Fine, and Amy Danzer ran the group, and it was about female desire.
And two guys were in the room. The room was packed, loaded with people. And after like 5 minutes or so, they're like, oh, man, we're not learning nothing about female desire.
Right.
These are a couple like broad authors, man. What are we doing here? That basically was it.
Right.
Were they embarrassed to walk out?
No.
They should have been embarrassed to be there.
Right.
Lisa Haynes, it is a remarkable thing to have known you low these many years, even if you did beat me racing when we were young.
Let's do it a few more decades, okay?
I'm not going to go out and race you on Michigan Avenue. Though it's kind of empty out there. Yeah, let's do it a few more decades, honey. When We Disappear is her latest novel. You should have all of her work on your shelf. Go to lisahaynes.com to do that. Love you.
Love you, too.
All right, sweetheart. All right. We'll be right back.
I recommend the life of a critic. What a life we lead. We quibble and carp, then attack like a shark, while the actors stand up there and bleed. And here's our critic's rule. We learn.
Welcome back to After Hours for the second hour. It's my real treat to have a colleague and a friend and a kid I greatly admire, who has two kids at home, two kids of his own, listening to the show. Josh Knoll has been one of the bright lights at the Chicago Tribune for how many years now?
13.
You've been there for 13 years?
Yeah, believe it or not. I've had about three different lives, so it seems like less, but it's been a ride.
What was it like
for
you? Since it's such a big deal, we left the Tribune on Friday and never to return to this majestic tower.
Yeah.
How'd you deal with that?
I'm in the haze of dealing with a six-week-old baby at home. And,
so who cares about where?
Well, and dealing with the book, so I'm a little distracted.
Yeah, who cares where
I
work?
But, you know, when I stop and think about it, on one hand, I do think it's a little sad because this is one of the most iconic buildings in one of the world's great cities, and this is one of, you know, the Tribune's changed a lot, but it's still one of the most recognizable newspapers and newspaper companies in the world. And we're leaving our home.
Yeah.
And we're leaving our home because a bunch of rich guys are, you know, playing a shell game. And
you know, my fantasy was in that piece I wrote today about leaving the tower.
Which is a great piece.
Thanks. But in 3 years, I want some, not to be, to have a heart attack, but some very nice and obviously wealthy person to be jarred from their sleep and scream at their wife or husband, oh my God, honey, I smell cigarette smoke. Let's get out of here. And run out in their pajamas on the Michigan Avenue. That's my fantasy. Josh's book is the result of his breaking the story about the sale of Goose Island to Anheuser-Busch a few years ago. I am not a beer drinker, and I hate beer, frankly. And I was so taken with this book because it is a story of fascinating characters. It's a story of big business. It's the story of, you know, it reminds me of, kind of, even though I wouldn't have been part of it at the time, of what it must have been like in the auto business in the early days about, you know, the guy buying up and sort of eating up these small independent people. It's the fight of big business versus independence, and you do a remarkable job with this narrative. Why don't I like beer? Josh Knoll.
You're starting with the hardest question first.
Yeah, because
the answer is, Rick, is because you haven't had the right one yet.
I know that's true.
Yeah.
Because I'm in an era where, I grew up in, you know, an old town in the 60s, and probably the first beer I ever had would have been, you know, an Anheuser-Busch
Old Style
Schlitz,
or Bud or, yeah.
Which are really terrible.
I don't care for Bud or Bud Light all that much, no. I have a little bit of a soft spot for Miller Lite. Believe
Do you
it or
really?
Not. Yeah, I mean, it's not at the top of my list, but on a hot day, yeah, that can quench a thirst. But yeah, there's other beers I'd reach for before it, for sure. But yeah, I think you just probably haven't had the right beer yet.
Well, I'm unlikely to have the right beer unless I'm invited to your house.
I can help. You're invited.
For the fifth, you do a wonderful job in the book, too, that detailing the history of beer, which I found fascinating, because Chicago was a huge center for this whole liquid refreshment, wasn't it?
Yep, Chicago. Well, no, the Midwest. I mean, this is the core of the entire industry, is this, you know, St. Louis, Milwaukee, and then, yeah, Chicago is right in between. And, the history is fascinating. And craft beer, which Goose Island, you know, was one of the forefathers of, started as a reaction.
But not the forefather.
A forefather.
Right.
I mean, they started in 1988, and I'd, you know, probably the earliest forefathers, Anchor Brewing, which dates to the 60s. And then there was a little Sierra Nevada, started in 1979. And then when Goose Island opened, there were about 200 breweries nationally.
Before we get to John Hall, who is the, I'm not quite sure how to characterize him, he's the very aggressive founder of Goose Island. What would compel a person before John Hall and Goose Island to start a beer company, at the time not obviously called a craft beer company? Mm-hmm. Why would they do, was it a hobbyist kind of endeavor?
A lot of them at that time were. A lot of the earliest founders of craft beer were people who brewed beer at home brewers, and they just wanted to create a reaction to Bud and Miller and Bud Light and Schlitz and Old Style. They wanted more flavorful beer, the stuff they made at home, and they thought there was a market for it out there in the world. And they were right. But John Hall was different from those guys in that he was, he opened Goose Island as the second act of his professional life. The first
right.
act was he was a white collar executive at Container Corporation in finance.
And apocryphally or not, he's on an airplane, correct?
Right.
I mean, you bring this up, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or if it's true. You would know. But, it, because, you know,
he
I think
swears it's true.
But yes, that's why I think it's apocryphal.
I know,
I think,
it's quite a story,
minute,
isn't it?
It's too good. Yeah, and you, as a typically as I am, suspicious reporter, go, oh, come on. But what is the story he tells?
Basically, he was... he was sitting in on an airplane. The plane was stuck in a rainstorm in Dallas. He grabs... right, so that part, maybe not.
See, I'm rolling my eyes in front of Jeff. That's why
he
may be giggling.
But yeah. he grabs the in-flight magazine to kill time. He's flipping through. He sees an article about... So craft beer was really not a term at the time. He saw an article about boutique breweries, and there was a particular small brewery...
Did anybody use the word craft beer at the time?
Yeah, actually, a few magazine writers have done sort of deep dive into the history of the term, and
yeah.
the earliest that anyone ever has been able to pin it to is 86, I want to say.
See,
Riz only used very much at the edges.
And I find the notion, I mean, I find the whole name a little, and react to this, a little precious, the whole name craft beer.
Yeah, no, I don't, you know, if I was hearing it with fresh ears for the first time,
right,
then
course,
you know what?
Sure.
Then it makes sense. Yeah, no,
yeah.
I can hear how that would sound a little precious.
Sure.
But it was literally handcrafted small batches when it started. It was very much a reaction to the literal waves of Budweiser that were Anheuser-Busch was making at the time, and which were just absolutely dominating American taps and store shelves.
Sure.
And it was... These you know, beers made in incredibly small batches, truly handcrafted. And obviously the industry has sort of moved beyond handcrafted in a lot of ways, not always. There's plenty of very
right,
small
I know
breweries.
Yeah, you bring that point too. But the other point you bring, I mean, we're going to be all over the map during this thing, that a lot of what we think of now as craft beer, the Josh Knoll craft beer and the Rick Kogan craft beer are often coming out of the same huge vats of beer. Right?
You mean the small beer or the craft beer?
No, I mean the big, as they sort of gather under that huge Anheuser-Busch umbrella.
Oh, well, yeah, and you're jumping to the end of the story.
Oh, no, I know, but
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, well, so Goose Island was, you know, was the entirety of Goose Island existed in that brew pub on Clybourne Avenue for 7 years. And then they started additionally brewing beer on Fulton Street at a time that apparently that was a really rough,
dicey
little
area,
yeah.
Sure.
And now Goose Island, the Goose Island beer in your hand could be made in Chicago. It could be coming out of the same tanks as Bud and Bud Light at an anonymous Anheuser-Busch brewery in upstate New York. And we, it's, you have to be a really savvy consumer to be able to tell the difference now.
And we, unlike me, we owe all that to John Ho. We're going to talk all about beer and how Anheuser-Busch just got it in their heads without knowing much, just saw a bunch of competitors. That's the other fascinating thing about your book. And again, the title of the book is Barrel Age Stout and Selling Out, Goose Island, Anheuser-Busch, and How Craft Beer Became Big Business. It became big business because big business went after craft beer.
Oh, yeah.
We will be back momentarily. I'll first tell you that one tiny Illinois community isn't just broke. It's been called one of the poorest in the country. Are things getting any better? WG Investigates Monday at 9. We'll be right back. Neighborhood. I'm talking to Josh Knoll for this entire hour about his wildly compelling book. And I'm telling you people, I wouldn't know a barrel-aged stout from a, what's another kind of beer?
Bud Light.
Bud Light. I wouldn't. I swear to you. And I think the reason for me is when I was young enough to start drinking and have fake IDs, I probably had a beer and said, this is really awful. I'd much rather have a Jack Daniels.
But wasn't your first sip of coffee you couldn't have liked? You couldn't have
liked. I didn't have coffee until I was like 25.
Okay.
So I've matured and I'm not a beer.
Beer just
now I don't drink any kind of coffee. But I figured out there are better ways to get drunk than drinking beer.
Okay.
Quicker,
if you just want to get to the to the point that beer is not necessarily.
I was never one of those, oh man, it's such a hot day, I think I'll have a nice cold beer. It was more like, oh, it's such a hot day, maybe on a really hot day I'll have a margarita on the rocks.
Okay.
Or more, put more ice in that bourbon for
that's
me.
Right.
But your book, you covered, how did you, Josh Knoll, get this beat in the first place?
Right beer writer. I was travel writer at the time.
Right, I remember,
Tribune.
Sure.
Excuse me. I did, and just for full context, I did crime for a long time before that.
Sure, I know.
And
that.
Then I just became travel writer because I thought, who wouldn't want to be a travel writer? And I got that job. And then there was no really much of a brewing industry here, but as it started to develop, and the food editor, Joe Gray, said, you know, he looked around and said, oh, you like beer? And I did. I liked beer. I was interested in beer. I had enough knowledge to write about it with some degree of expertise. He said, there, you know, the beer industry here is sort of, we need someone to just sort of keep an eye on what's going on with beer. Would you mind doing it when you're not traveling? And I said, of course.
We want to write about beer and travel. Sure.
And it just became more and more and more of my job as the Chicago beer industry went from, you know, 5 breweries to now about 75 breweries. And there's no shortage of things to write. You know, cultural sort of appreciation, hard business stories. You know, I broke the news about on Friday about a brewery that's stopped making beer in Chicago and is now up for sale.
That's
called Bader Brow.
They used to make the Billy Goat beer.
Yep,
they made
exactly,
Billy Goat
exactly,
beer.
Yeah.
You obviously met in this world a number of very, very compelling people who you write about in the book. Among them, a guy named Michael Roper. Talk to me about him.
Oh, Michael Roper is, I mean, if you're going to make
he's a pioneer
yeah,
in this.
There's a Mount Rushmore of Chicago bar owners, at least in the last, you know, 25 years. He's on it. He started Hop Leaf up in Andersonville.
Yep.
Or actually, as you will point out, it's not quite in Andersonville.
It's just south of Foster. Yeah.
Don't make that mistake. He will correct you. he was about good beer before almost anyone in this town. He was, I think, literally the first bar owner to say, you know, there are, see that there are a few bars in town selling what, you know, quote unquote good beer, and he was the first to say, that's all I'm going to sell. I will sell no Bud, no Bud Light, no Schlitz, no Old Style, blah, 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 blah.
Just, why did he do that? What motivated him to do that? It could not simply have been because those other beers, certainly at the time, were harder to get. I mean, you'd have a Bud drop up and say, here we are.
It was very hard for him to get those beers. And the beers that he served when he started in 96, I want to say it was, he would never serve a bunch of those beers now. Because, you know, what was quote-unquote good beer then is not, you know, and what was available is a world away from what's available now.
And he's the sole arbiter of this.
He and his wife, yep. He did it, I think he did it, he saw it partly as a business opportunity. He saw a hole in the market. He saw that no one else was doing that exact thing. But really, for him, it was about passion. It was about wanting, about loving, again, I'll say quote unquote good beer, even though I do think that is, you know, I'll certainly call that good beer. You know, just loving and appreciating that beer and wanting to provide a stage for it for Chicago.
Yeah. So when you, let's go back to John Hall, the man behind Goose Island. He had, it seems to me, from your book, big ambitions right away. It wasn't like, oh, I'm tired of the corporate life. I think I'm going to start a small little brewery and make good beer. Mm-hmm. It was way beyond that, was it not?
It was what you just described, but it was also more. And a lot of the earliest craft beer founders, Larry Bell of Bell's Brewery in Michigan, Ken Grossman, who started Sierra Nevada, these were young, scruffy guys who just loved home brewing and just wanted to share their beer with the world. And they're almost, I call these guys like accidental businessmen. Yeah. You know, it's like they just sort of stumbled onto something good while doing what they loved. John Hall was very much a beer fan, but he also saw a hole in the market. And
he's a pragmatist. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And even when this is when I started to know that I was really onto a good book, is maybe halfway through the reporting. So this was, you know, in an interview 3-4 years ago.
Sure.
But he told me that when he opened the Fulton Street Goose Island Production Brewery in 1995, he thought, all the way back then, he thought, well, my plan is I'm going to steal Heineken's business. I'm going after the imports. Everyone who's drinking Heineken now will be drinking my beer in, you know, the next few years. And maybe down the road, I'll sell my brewery to Heineken because they're going to need to buy what I do. So all the way back then, he was thinking about maybe selling Goose Island and whose business he was going to take. And that you know, they were going to have to solve their problem by buying him out.
One of them, we'll end this half hour. I'm Team Josh till all the way till 11 o'clock because the book is so fascinating. Let's end this half hour with one of the highlights to me in the book is and one of the most dramatic points in the book is when Mr. Hall announces to his employees that he has decided, many of whom are, you know, craft beer beyond aficionados, diehards.
Yeah.
When he announces that he is selling, that he has sold this company to Anheuser-Busch for, what, $38 million?
$38.8 million.
I have a good memory. $38.8 million. What was their general reaction, Josh Noel?
There was a lot of people were crying. Yeah. Literally. People were crying as he made the announcement. People were angry. He tried to console some people who he could tell were upset. This one woman wouldn't even look him in the eye. She just walked away. Can you imagine that? Your boss comes up to talk to you and you just walk away.
I try to do that every time my boss comes up to talk to me.
How does that work out for you? We have the same boss. So.
Yeah, it's been okay. It's been all right.
That whole chapter just takes place in the one day, basically, where he makes the announcement. It's the only chapter like that. That was the hardest one of the hardest and probably the most fun chapter to assemble. Because there is so much tension and drama that day.
Well, and the other thing is, as a reporter, you have incredibly... This is not a rehash of Josh Noel's stories about this. There is some deep, detailed reporting in here that does way more than flesh out the story. It gives it a new kind of life that extends way beyond what... I like to read Josh Noel about beer. This is Josh Noel about life. They're fascinating characters in this book. We got to get a break, and we got to get some news, and we will continue on. I want to know especially about Anheuser-Busch so screwed this up. when it decided to buy Goose Island. It's not even funny. I'm surprised there still is a Goose Island, frankly. Back with Josh Knoll again. The title of the book is Barrel Aged Stout and Selling Out. And there is a subtitle, Goose Island, Anheuser-Busch, and How Craft Beer Became Big Business. We'll be back. Never spoken. I am talking to Josh Knoll. I am absolutely besmitten with his book, Barrel Aged Stout and Selling Out, even though it's one of those rare, I don't know, you know, what Moby Dick means, and I don't know what Barrel Aged Stout is, but I'm not putting them in the same exact class. But for a top, it reminds me of the way I fell in love with the New Yorker magazine. I would come across a piece about something I had never heard of. I think one of the first, I was a teenager, and it was a piece about squash and about some famous Indian family playing squash. And I didn't know what squash was, and I fell in love with the story and the writer. And the same is true here. It doesn't matter that this is about beer. It's about corporate shenanigans. It's about the big guy versus David versus Goliath. It's about Anheuser-Busch, which bought Goose Island for $38.8 million and then proceeded to almost screw it up. Did they not?
They screwed some things up, yeah. There's no two ways about it. And in fact, as they, so Goose Island was the first of 10 American craft breweries that Anheuser-Busch
was this
bought.
Was this their plan?
It was not.
Because I think craft beer caught them completely off guard in the complacent way that, you know, newspapers used to behave. Like, we'll be making all this money forever. What could ever come around to stop us?
No, you're exactly right. In the 90s, craft beer had its first surge, and Anheuser-Busch...
By surge, what does that mean?
It just began to
sell in a volume that Anheuser-Busch
exactly,
would notice.
Yeah, exactly. It began to just sort of steal market share from the rest of the industry.
Yeah.
I mean, for so long, it was about Bud, it was about Schlitz, it was about Miller. And, you know, and then there's some other regional brands, but all the beers tasted the same. And in the 90s is when craft beer really started to grab some share of the pie. And so Anheuser-Busch in the 90s, they started sort of dabbling in making craft beer, and they were just sort of nosing around, but they just wanted it to go away. They just wanted it to die.
Did they think it would, though?
They did.
I mean,
did.
In the same way,
yeah.
We think of newspapers and like, well, there's just something called the internet, and, you know, let's give our material away free and it'll go away.
Oops.
Yeah, oops. But did they think it would vanish? Did they think it was kind of a passing fancy?
They did, yeah. And it looked like they were right for a while, because then the craft beer industry sort of tanked in about 98, 99, 2000, and then for 7 years or so, until about, let's say, 2005 or so, craft beer wasn't really much of a thing. The number of breweries in the nation was declining.
Right, you have these charts and statistics in here, too.
And then by 05, 06, 07, it became clear. They said, oh, dear, you know, craft beer's back. Tastes have fragmented. The way people drink beer is just not, it's not going back. We have to get into craft beer.
Hmm.
Also, the ownership changed to Anheuser-Busch.
Well, was this at the same time that this Brazilian company was buying Anheuser-Busch, which took me by surprise? I always think of this as a classic, iconic American.
It was. It's not anymore. Now it's part of a Brazilian-Belgian conglomerate, $250 billion company.
That then was one of, you know, they put an old Anheuser-Busch hand in charge of Goose Island. And was that, I mean, these Brazilian bosses are so far removed, they don't really know what they're doing. They just said, put this guy in charge. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, well, the guy John Hall got fed up. After he stuck around at Goose Island for about a year and a half after the sale, he got fed up and he was ready to go. Anheuser-Busch was ready for him to go. So John left and they stuck just a career AB guy in his place as the new boss at Goose Island.
Like a marketing guy, too, with an emphasis on
marketing. Total marketing guy, yeah. Very nice guy, a sharp guy, But his job was not to make Goose Island a you know, better craft brewery. It was to fold Goose Island into the Anheuser-Busch universe, which hadn't really happened for the first year or so after the sale. And that was his job, and there were a lot of bumps along the way. They rolled Goose Island out nationally way too fast over the objections of John Hall.
Right, right, right.
And his you know, longtime the leadership at the brewery. And Goose Island suffered as a result. And they figured it out. It took them a while, Anheuser-Busch, but they did figure out that they screwed up, they moved too fast. And they actually used that as part of the sales pitch when buying the other nine breweries.
They said, look, we didn't do it right here, but we'll do right by you.
Exactly, exactly.
What was it when they went out to these? I find this fascinating, too. When they went out to these other nine breweries, and many of them started, as you detail, by you know, zealots, smart zealots, not crazy zealots.
Zealots, the guys who just, like, They just want different beer.
But obviously, Anheuser-Busch made the kind of offer you cannot refuse, right?
Yeah, well, there's one guy who sold his brewery in Colorado said about 6 months before the sale, he was decrying the breweries that sold Anheuser-Busch. He said, you know, when you sell, you lose a piece of yourself and you're, you know, undercutting the rest of their independent businesses, and you know, and 6 months later he sold Anheuser-Busch.
Yeah.
And it was
just, the money was
just
too good.
Crucified him on it,
but the money, it,
you know, I mean, all, yeah, if someone shows up with a check for $100 million, you start, you know, reconsidering your priorities real quick.
Did Anheuser-Busch, after they got these nine new things, did they get a better understanding? You said they have a better understanding of how to market it.
Mm-hmm.
What about the making of it, though?
I think they've gotten better at it. I think they've realized that they can't just blast craft beer out from coast to coast. That works for Bud Light. It works for Miller Light. It works for those kinds of beers. It does not work for an IPA.
Well, tell people, you have a great, and it's very short, a great sort of definition of Craig, a classic definition of craft beer, it's always meant. And
yeah,
it's very simple.
The classic definition is set by the Brewers Association, a trade group in Colorado, small, traditional, independent.
Yeah.
So really, you can't make more than 6 million barrels of beer, which no craft brewer really comes even close. Like Goose Island made 600,000 last year.
Yeah.
So Goose Island falls well under the threshold. But the most contentious and key part of the definition is really ownership. You can't be owned by a company that itself is not a craft brewer. Anheuser-Busch obviously makes way more than 6 million barrels of beer.
Yeah.
So therefore, Goose Island and all the other breweries that Anheuser-Busch acquired are no longer considered craft because they're owned by Big Bad Anheuser-Busch.
We got to take one more break, then we'll come back. I want to talk certainly about a fellow in the book named Greg Hall, the son of John Hall, who is a compelling character. To my mind, he's kind of like the Jim Morrison of this book.
I hope he's listening.
Interesting character. And then I want to finish with this. If I haven't convinced you to buy this book, you really haven't been listening, because this is it's a great Chicago story. It's a great business story. It's a great beer story. You will be enlightened, and it's just a great narrative. Your job of writing this thing, Josh, you've always been a good writer, but you have topped yourself with this, because it's longer than your newspaper stories. We will be right back after a short commercial break.
All right.
I got to tell you this, Dean Richards is back from Hawaii, and he will dish all of the details about his trip with Steve Cochran at 8:10 a.m. I have a few more minutes with Josh Knoll, who's written what I really will call a remarkable book, and I say this as someone who hates beer, Barrel-Aged Stout and Selling Out, Goose Island, Anheuser-Busch, and How Craft Beer Became Big Business. I just want to read one little paragraph from the book. There are any number of great paragraphs in here. He is talking now about the son of the man who founded Goose Island. As a legend of Greg Hill grew, no one seemed to believe it more than Greg himself. Many of his meetings happened in bars over beers as he expounded on the history of beer, the future of beer, and his vision for Goose Island. He ordered course after course of food and beer and explained the intricacies of what was unfolding on the table. He could talk for half an hour uninterrupted. He was good at it. He spoke of beer like poetry, using words like craggy to describe a beer's foamy head. He never seemed to doubt himself. This is quite a character, Josh Knoll.
Yeah, he is truly one of the most original and visionary people in the history of the American craft beer movement.
Yeah.
Not a very gifted technical brewer by his own accord, but he knew the history of beer. He had done all the reading. He studied. He was a believer in you learn by tasting, so he tasted all the great beers. And he just was able to intuit what consumers in America would want next.
Yeah.
And he was good at it. And he's a unique guy.
As an iconoclast.
He's an iconoclast too.
No question about it. There's another scene in the book that I cannot read about, but
probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
But he's a unique guy, and he was, you know, you need a little bit of that recklessness and cockiness and arrogance, you know, to be a visionary, I think, you know. So I mean, I use those words with admiration.
Yeah. What has been, and in a book that is so detailed, and it is hardly the kind of perfect, pretty picture that I'm sure some of the people in the book would have liked to see. It's deeply reported. You've got a lot of sources who are telling you things that they would not tell a newspaper reporter for a piece. What's been the reaction for some of the people featured in this book?
Still digging through that a little bit. I can tell you that the reaction from people outside the book, the people who have, I've had a lot of good press. I think people are really wanting this story to be told. People are ready for sort of a deep dive into a history of craft beer other than this happened,
these
and this happened, and this happened.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, basically, and I don't
more
mean...
More than appreciation, more than just sort of straight linear narrative, sort of digging into how it became so political and sort of the nuance of how your beer winds up in your glass and who, you know, what's at stake and who owns what and what big beer doesn't want you to know. I mean, they're, you know, I don't think Anheuser-Busch is terribly thrilled with the book because
what was this ad? There was a full-page ad earlier this week in the Tribune.
Yeah, on the back page of the Food and Dining section, which is the section where my beer coverage happens to be. The Goose Island took out an ad this week, full-page ad, signed by John Hall and Greg Hall, even though neither has run the brewery for 7 years since the sale. But, you know, you look at that ad and you might think they're still running it, but they're not. It was, I think it was a, sort of a vaguely coded response to the book. I think they just wanted to sort of take back a little bit of the narrative and try to, I don't know.
That didn't work.
I don't know if anything, it sort of maybe heightened the narrative a little bit, so I appreciate them doing it.
Have you talked to either of them?
I've been doing a series of readings around town. I've done 5 or 6 of them so far, and Greg has come to the last 4.
Huh.
Yeah, he just...
Just sitting there.
He just sits there in the back and listens. We haven't really hashed it all out, but he's been interested.
Do you have any things coming up that people might? How can you abandon your 2 kids like this?
That's why my wife was texting me as we were about. She is a saint. She's wonderful, and she's not listening because I'm sure she's sleeping. Hopefully. It's doing this with 2 kids, a 3-year-old and a 6-week-old.
Oh, my God, I can't even imagine.
I guess 2-month-old now. Coming up on Thursday, this coming Thursday, I'm going to be at Lagunitas Brewing down near Pilsen, talking to the founder of Lagunitas, Tony McGee, who's been a long time. He's enjoyed poking Goose Island in the ribs a little bit. But he sold Lagunitas to Heineken, so he had his own, quote-unquote, sellout experience. So there's a lot there, you know?
Yeah.
So that should be an interesting conversation.
What is the future of, I mean... Do you think at any point Anheuser-Busch, with now these 9 craft breweries, do you think that they know how to sell beer? There's no question about that.
Yeah, they're the best at it.
Will craft beers ever sell more than the junk beers that I first tasted as a kid?
Well, junk beer is losing its, your words, not mine,
yes,
losing share by the
proudly.
Year and has and will probably continue to for a long time. Craft beer is continuing to grow every year. The growth is slowing, but it's still growing. Yeah, people just think about, we're just a radically different society than we were a generation, two generations ago.
Sure.
You know, you used to be a Bud guy or you were a Schlitz guy. Now you drink, beer drinkers drink all sorts of different stuff.
It's a more sophisticated taste buds or something.
Yeah, and people are just, people are searchers. They're trying different things.
Do you think there's any, is the possibility of another kind of Goose Island phenomenon happening? Is a guy going to, stuck in an airport in Cleveland now, picking up a magazine, reading a review of your book, thinking to himself, wait a minute, maybe I should start a craft brewing company?
Well, I think the time to do that was a few years back.
Yeah, I do
now
too.
There were 200 when Goose Island started, now there's 6,500. So it's getting...
Do you think there's an end, 10,000, 9,000?
10,000, actually 10,000 is the number that Greg Hall would always cite as where he thinks the ceiling for the industry is. But
yeah.
I think there's a lot of growth ahead, but those breweries, new breweries are going to have to be content to be small businesses, basically, very
mm-hmm.
local. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, those are some, many
yeah,
of the best ones are,
yeah,
are
sure.
very small.
Without, I mean, the people would be foolhardy to have the ambition that
oh,
in
yeah.
the same way they're starting an online, you know, some kind of internet company thinking, well, Google will buy me. That
right.
would be foolhardy, you
right.
would say.
And those people were open, those were the exact people that were opening breweries 3-4 years ago when it seemed like craft beer was a can't-miss business. And a lot of those people are no longer in the industry.
Interesting. If you were to have tomorrow morning, though you shouldn't drink in the morning on your way to the new Chicago Tribune offices, if you were to have one beer, what's your favorite beer these days?
Ooh.
I'm sure you love, I mean, being on the beat you are, the, what's your favorite beer is like maybe the next beer, I think.
Well, it does change a lot. I almost look forward to the day when I'm not covering beer, writing about beer anymore, because then I'll be able to drink beer like a normal person.
Right now,
I'm
too discriminating. You have to be too discriminating.
Well, and it's just I'm drinking with a sense of purpose and searching. I'm just curious about new things.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I did try lately that really sort of knocked my socks off, but it's very, it's not a flashy beer. It's fairly simple beer, and it almost, to some people, would taste like one of the quote-unquote junk beers. But Spiteful Brewing is a very small brewery in Chicago on the north side. They're up in Ravenswood. They've got a brand new Spiteful Lager, and it's just a nice, it's like, to me, a beautiful version of what Miller Lite and Bud Light should taste like.
Josh Knoll, this is a remarkable book. I know you've written one before, collaborated on one before, but Barrel Aged Stout and Selling Out, Goose Island, Anheuser-Busch, and How Craft Beer Became Big Business. It's a great narrative, some intrigue, a lot of interesting characters, and a great story. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Rick.
See you at the office tomorrow.
For sure, yeah.
I'll find your new desk. We got to take a commercial break, and then we will sign off another edition of After Hours.